James found his family waiting up toward the head of the line, nearing their turn for the ferry. Annie was the first to recognize him and come running. She threw her arms around him and squeezed him with all her strength.
Careful. You don't want to be hurting yourself. You're not in a shape to be taking chances.
Oh, I'm not that fragile. We've been afraid you'd never come back.
James looked over her shoulder. He could see Marie and Petra and the children. The wagon sheet had been pulled back because it was not raining, and Frank sat in the wagon bed, a blanket wrapped around him. Hope knelt beside her husband. Marie and Petra came up. James dreaded what he had to tell Marie.
I never did find Michael. Found where he'd been, but he was gone. I'm mighty sorry.
Marie put her arm around his shoulder.
It's all right, James. I know you tried.
James felt a wetness as she laid her cheek against his. Petra was next.
I never saw anything of Andrew either.
Andrew is with the army, with Houston.
He was looking for us when we got here. He made sure we were all right, then he went back.
Relief washed over James. At least one brother was not lost.
I'm glad we left Frank to get you all away from the place in time. I was afraid.
You were afraid a bunch of women couldn't take care of ourselves. Shows how much you know about Lewis women, James. Frank was too sick to help. We thought for a while we might lose him. We did just fine, us women and the children. And we did have a man.
Annie beckoned to young Mordecai. She put her arm around the boy.
Michael would have been proud of him.
Mordecai gave James a thin smile as James shook his head.
We best move the wagons up. The ferry will be ready to load us as soon as it gets back from the other side.
I'll see you onto the ferry, then I'll be going to find the army. I owe it to Michael.
You owe it to Isaac Blackwood, too. Isaac was in the Alamo. We brought Nellie and her young'uns with us.
She pointed. James had not noticed them before.
What about Finnis and Luke?
What do you think? They let out and left Nellie standing there.
It runs in the blood.
Not all the blood. Not Isaac's.
James walked along, leading the sorrel horse, as Annie and Marie pulled the wagons up to the ferry landing. He had to explain to Mordecai what had happened to Walker and how he happened to have a different horse than he had left home with. He noticed a man standing at the landing, watching the ferry's return across the water. The stance was familiar. When the man turned, James knew.
Sly Shipman.
He caught up with us at the Blackwoods place. He stayed with us the rest of the way.
James wondered if Shipman knew about Annie's condition. Annie started to climb down from the wagon. James watched the gentle way Shipman helped her. He knew.
I ought to kill him.
Why?
You're too young to understand.
You'd make a widow out of Aunt Annie if you did.
A widow?
He found a preacher in camp right after we got here.
They're married?
They stood out in the mud while the preacher married them. Wasn't nothing fancy, but they sure did draw a crowd.
Shipman saw James for the first time. James walked up and shook his hand.
Mordecai tells me you're a Lewis now.
I'm taking a wife. I didn't take a new name.
As strong-minded as Annie is, she'll have you thinking you did. You going to take everybody to your place up on the Sabine?
No. I'm seeing them onto the ferry, and then I'm going to find Houston's army.
I was figuring on the same. We can ride together if it's all right with you.
I got no objection. You don't look as eager as you did that time at Velasco.
I'm older now. I hope I'm smarter.
As the ferry pulled in, James shook hands with Frank and the youngsters, then hugged the four women. Annie and Shipman said a long goodbye. The two men stood together, watching the ferry pull away.
We've got a long ride ahead of us.
Shipman nodded, taking one last look at the ferry and its precious cargo.
Let's be getting about it, then.
Sam Houston's troops looked nothing like James's idea of an army. Certainly nothing like those of General Coss, whom he had faced in the siege of San Antonio de Bar. There were no uniforms, save for a few imaginative get-ups worn by officers who had followed their individual fancies. The men wore all manner of clothing, from buckskins to the muddied and torn remnants of what had probably once been suits fit to wear to a wedding. They wore wool hats, skin caps, wide-brimmed Mexican sombreros. They were farmers, hunters, trappers, old Texas settlers, and new volunteers from almost every part of the United States. About the only thing they had outwardly in common was that they were bearded and dirty, muddied from the struggle that had carried them across a large part of American Texas, retreating, halting, retreating again in the face of Santa Anna's relentless march. They were hungry looking, for rations were short. Only a few of the luckier ones, mostly officers, had tents to shelter them from the chilly April rains. They exhibited little of the discipline James had witnessed in the Mexican soldiers under Cos. Riding into camp with Shipman, he watched an officer trying in vain to draw his company into formation. Those who complied did so indifferently, and others ignored the officer completely and told him they'd fall in when they felt like it. These were free men, proudly individualistic, unwilling to abandon their personal freedom to anybody or anything. But they would fight. James had seen that at Belasco and San Antonio. His and Shipman's arrival occasioned little notice, for many latecomers had been riding in to join Houston's force. Others, with and without permission, had been riding out to see after their families, as James had seen them do during the siege of San Antonio. These were soldiers only by individual consent, and only for however long they felt like staying. Fortunately for Houston, most were inclined to stay and have it out with Santa Anna. Many were impatient because it had not been done already. They had wanted to fight him at Gonzales, then at San Felipe. Now, near the town of Harrisburg, they were spoiling again to confront the Mexican army. But Houston had stalled, retreating, despite the grumbling by officers and men that he was afraid, that he had no intention of facing around and giving Santa Anna a taste of Texas steel. James had never seen the man, though we had heard the name often in the past year or two. Houston was not one to go about quietly and unnoticed, for his was always a commanding presence. James was sure he recognized him standing in front of a tent. He was a square-faced giant of a man, well over 6 feet tall, his face framed by mutton chop whiskers. He wore a much-abused black dress coat. The broad brim of his hat was turned up in three-corner style. On his feet were a pair of decorative moccasins that indicated an Indian woman's hand. That fitted with what James had heard about Houston being at one with the Indians, particularly the Cherokees, and able to treat even with the wild Comanches. Houston spied James and Shipman and hailed them.
You two, what's your outfit?
We don't have one. We just got here.
Where from?
I come from out on the Colorado. Shipman here is my brother-in-law. We just saw our family onto the ferry. We've come to join up.
I don't suppose you fetched along any grain for those horses?
No, sir. I reckon they'll have to get by on grass.
There's damn little of that. I have 800 men in this camp, and sometimes it seems that half of them have horses. Doesn't anybody want to be infantry anymore?
I'll be whatever you want me to be. I walked most of the way from the Rio Grande to the Colorado River. I reckon I can walk some more. Horse ain't mine anyway. I'm just taking the borrow of him.
Well, this horse is mine, and I ain't about to give him up.
Houston appeared disposed to give Shipman an argument.
I have a brother here somewhere. I'd like to join up with whatever bunch he's in.
That headed Houston off with nothing more than a scowl for Shipman. He waved to a junior officer.
See if you can help this man find an outfit. That other insubordinate son of a bitch, too.
Houston turned back into his tent.
He treats his own men that way. He must be hell on his enemies.
The younger officer made a thin smile.
It's not personal. You'd be quarrelsome, too, if you were a bulldog and had a bunch of yapping little terriers nipping at your heels.
The young officer beckoned the two into another tent.
We're looking for Andrew Lewis.
The officer searched through a set of rosters.
We were on the point of a mutiny. Some who wanted to march right out and attack Santa Anna without any thought to the consequences. The general has wanted to delay until the families had time to get to safety, and he's wanted to pick his own battleground. I believe he knows what he's doing.
They said 800 men. I heard Santa Anna has got several thousand.
He does, but not all in one place. Our spies tell us he has moved out ahead of his main force. He wants to cut us off before we can cross the Sabine to safety.
James looked at Shipman, whose face reflected James's own disappointment.
Is that what we're fixing to do?
You'd have to ask the general, and he wouldn't tell you. But I don't think he has any intention of crossing the Sabine. There are some in camp who still call him a coward. But I prefer to believe he's baiting a trap.
The officer found that Andrew had joined an infantry company and had relinquished his horse to an officer of cavalry.
I reckon I can do the same.
Be damned if I give up a good horse. Anything that can't be done a horseback ain't worth doing. Put me with a cavalry outfit.
James found Andrew without much difficulty. The two embraced each other fiercely, for each had feared the other had lost to the enemy. Shipman stood quietly holding his horse until the two brothers had finished their greeting. Andrew finally took time to shake hands with him.
How'd you leave Annie?
Wasn't easy, but I saw her onto the ferry with the rest of the family.
You'd be proud of them, Andrew. Petra, Annie, Marie, and Hope. They did real well. And Mordecai. I never did find Michael. I'm afraid we may never know what happened to him.
Yeah, he wasn't in the Alamo. Manuel Zaragoza told me that.
Manuel? When did you see him?
He's here. He came to Houston's army after the Alamo fell. He's with Juan Seguin's Mexican company.
But Manuel is just a boy.
Yeah, there are a lot of men in this camp who would be boys anywhere else. He lost a good friend in the Alamo. Manuel saw his father's body there after the battle. Isaac Blackwood was there, too.
I figured he was. I didn't know about Alessandro.
He had not gotten to know Zaragoza well, but he knew the Mexican had been a staunch friend to Michael and Andrew.
We've lost a lot of good men. What do you think of our own chances?
Yeah, I won't lie to you. We've gone about as far as we can go. If we march much farther, we'll be backed up against Galveston Bay. Looks to me like we'll fight or swim. If we fight, we're outnumbered. If we wait for the rest of Santa Ana's troops to come up, they'll have us outmanned by 4 or 5 to 1. If you were Sam Houston, what would you do?
James searched Andrew's face but found none of his brother's usual cheerfulness.
I'm glad I'm not him.
If we fight and win, you'll be a great hero. If we lose, there'll be 3 widows in the Lewis camp instead of 1, and they'll curse Sam Houston's memory.
Houston did not even know the name of the field where he had chosen to fight. He asked and was told it was San Jacinto, Spanish for Saint of the Hyacinths. While his cavalry swam their horses over the wide expanse of Buffalo Bayou, he crossed his walking army on Lynch's Ferry and camped it in a grove of moss-strewn live oak trees before the broad open plain of San Jacinto. Even as late as April 20th, his command suffered from dissension in the ranks, jealousy among his officers, and doubt about his intention to fight. The men were weary of the long marches, the cold and boggy campgrounds, the pervasive illnesses that swept the army, intensified by hardships of hunger and exposure to the weather. A chill was still in the air that cloudy day, and few, if any, other than Houston, knew for sure what was in his mind. James, an infantry private, far removed from the center of command, knew only that many of the men were complaining. He saw no sense in this endless retreat. What they could see was the enemy moving into position to cut them off. Behind the Texan troops lay boggy Buffalo Bayou. To the east lay the even wider San Jacinto River. In front of them, south and southeast, were the Mexicans. The only opening for further retreat was southwestward, and Santa Ana could close off that avenue in short order if he so chose. A 40-man Texas cavalry patrol early that morning had encountered Santanista scouts and had killed 4 of them in a running skirmish, then had watched Santa Ana's column leave a small settlement known as New Washington. The Mexicans moved into an encampment of their own, not a mile from Houston's. With Houston now were 2 recently arrived cannons, which the men were calling the Twin Sisters, bought and paid for by donations from the citizens of Cincinnati. Houston ordered these rolled out in front of the grove. Santa Ana, feeling contemptuous of the undisciplined Texas force and confident that he now had it trapped, sent out a company of skirmishers and wheeled out a 12-pound cannon by way of challenge. The cannon's shot went over the Texans and splashed harmlessly into the waters of Buffalo Bayou behind them. The skirmishers fired their muskets without effect. The range was too great. The twin sisters answered the Mexican cannon shot for shot, finally striking the Mexican gun carriage and killing two mules. As the Mexicans began to retreat, dragging the cannon with too few mules, a Texan cavalry unit sallied forth in an effort to capture it. The resultant heated skirmish failed to take the Mexican cannon, but enlivened the fighting spirits of the Texan camp. James and Andrew huddled over a campfire that night, listening to the telling and retelling of the day's two cavalry skirmishes. Sly Shipman had been among the horsemen involved, but he was not talking much. While around the encampment, the Texans were making heroes of the participants. Shipman came to the Lewis's campfire and avoided the celebration. He sat moodily, staring into the flames.
What's the matter? People are trying to give you a medal. You look like somebody had taken a whip to you.
I don't feel like a hero. Fact is, I was scared half out of my britches there a time or two. All I could think of was Annie and wondering if I was ever going to see her again. Or that baby on the way, wondering if I was ever going to see it at all. They could know what I was thinking, they'd be calling me a coward.
You've been dodging Mexican soldiers a big part of your life. Haven't you ever been scared before?
Not this scared. Maybe I didn't ever have so much to lose before. There's Annie now, and our baby.
I bet you half the men in camp are thinking along the same lines. That's why they're making so much fuss over what y'all did. Gives them heart. Helps keep their minds off what's likely coming.
What do you think is coming?
A fight. It'll be tomorrow. It has to be.
Why?
This camp is ready. It reminds me of when we had the siege on San Antonio last December. We'd sat there and waited and waited while the officers argued over what we ought to do. All we needed was a spark to touch off the powder. Along comes old Ben Milam and furnishes a spark. He raises a holler, and half the camp follows him into San Antonio. I think the general is probably ready for a fight now. And even if he isn't, he'll come anyway. Because there's plenty of men in camp ready to do what Ben Milam did. They'll raise a holler, and off we'll go.
Dawn of April 21st found the skies clearing and the cold wind dying down after having blown hard in the last hours of darkness. Nine more volunteers arrived in a small cutter they had rowed up from the bay. James could see 20 or 30 campfires sending up their smoke along the 400 yards or so of the Texan encampment. To the southeast, no more distant than perhaps a mile, James knew the Mexicans were encamped in another patch of woods. He could see them because of a gentle rise in the open prairie that separated the two armies. He had never regained track of the days after his long walk across Texas.
Andrew, what day is it?
Sunday?
James expected at any time to hear a command for the troops to fall in, to prepare for battle. The command did not come. He saw Sly Shipman and some of the other cavalrymen leading their horses out into the open to graze. Perhaps he'd been wrong. Perhaps there was to be no fight. The hours wore on, and a new report swept through the camp. Santa Anna's forces had been reinforced early this morning. Texan scouts had counted some 500 of them marching in from the direction of Vince's Bridge across Buffalo Bayou. At the head of the column was the same General Koss who had defended, then abandoned, San Antonio in December. This would bring Santa Anna's strength to something like 1,500 men, the scouts reported. And the main force was still marching up from the south. When it arrived, the Texans would be hopelessly outnumbered. With their backs to the wide, deep bayou, they would be even more vulnerable than the men of the Alamo. None of the officers had solicited James's opinions, so he kept them to himself. He was aware that Houston and several of his field officers conducted a long council well into the afternoon. An officer came to his company.
Listen close, men. We have two choices. We can attack the enemy across the open plain, or we can wait in the woods and let the enemy come to us.
Let's go and get him!
Let's go get him!
Get out the plain! Yeah!
Get him!
Looking at the sun, James guessed it was past 3 PM when an order was relayed along the length of the encampment.
Form up!
James and Andrew and the other men afoot made a double line just beyond the edge of the wood. Cavalry units were interspersed, with one on each end of a long, long line that James guessed must stretch 800 or 900 yards. Just in front of the line waited the twin sisters, the cannons which had seen their first fire in combat the day before. Though the Mexican camp was out of sight beyond the rising ground, James felt sure that sentries or scouts must be watching. Yet tall Sam Houston, parading back and forth in front of the line on a big white stallion, was preparing to lead these men in a frontal assault against Santa Anna's superior force.
Remember the Alamo! Remember Goliad!
A short distance down the line, James could see the dark-skinned men in Juan Seguin's company of Mexican volunteers. Seguin had missed being in the fall of the Alamo because Travis had sent him out as a courier in search of reinforcements. James could see the slight form of young Manuel Zaragoza and wondered what thoughts must be running through his mind now as he prepared to take vengeance for the slaughter of his father and so many others.
Trail arms! Forward!
The line began its awkward movement away from the woods and out upon the open plain, most of 800 men marching to free Texas or die. James's mouth was dry, but his hands were wet and slick against the rifle. At any moment, he expected the Mexican guns to open up. He expected Santa Anna's big 12-pounder to begin blowing holes in this ragged Texan line, followed by a rush of Mexican cavalry. It would be easy to outflank this unwieldy formation and cut it down as a farmer might cut a row of wheat with a scythe. But incredibly, it did not happen. He watched, hardly believing, as the artillerymen towed the twin sisters in front of the infantry line. He wondered how many times artillery had ever charged into battle like foot soldiers. They had topped the rise and were almost upon the Mexican camp before the first alarm went up. James realized with amazement that they had caught Santa Anna and his men at Sunday siesta. So contemptuous had El Presidente been of the Texans that he had neglected even to post a normal guard. It had been unthinkable that Houston would be foolhardy enough to attack such a superior force across a mile of open ground. Yet this was exactly what the Texans had done. James would later learn that Santa Anna was in his tent, amusing himself with a pretty young mulatto slave girl he had captured at a nearby plantation. Not even the first sounds of scattered musket fire from his own troops brought him out to investigate. By the time he became alarmed, it was too late. At a range of some 200 yards, the twin sisters opened up on the Mexican camp. The infantry and the cavalry moved out of a walk and into a run. Mexican escopetas were answered by Texan rifles and shotguns. The cavalry ripped into the Mexicans' flank with a fiery vengeance as foot soldiers burst into and over Santa Anna's outer guard.
Remember the Alamo! Remember Goliad!
James tried to stay close beside Andrew as they rushed into the fringes of the Mexican camp. In front of him, he saw rifles stacked for siesta. Some of the suddenly awakened soldiers rallied and grabbed their weapons. Others, demoralized, began to run headlong toward the south, unarmed, spreading panic like wildfire as they went. James saw Andrew's rifle bring down a soldier. Another soldier who had already fired came rushing with a bayonet. He would impale Andrew if James didn't stop him. As at Velasco and San Antonio, powder smoke quickly clouded the battleground like a fog. James paused to reload his rifle, his hands trembling. His eyes began to burn. He saw Andrew prime the pan on his rifle and start moving again. Though not ready, James quickly followed, trying not to spill powder from his horn. For a few minutes, a portion of the Mexican force rallied and put up a brave resistance. But too many had fled, and those who tried to stand and fight were quickly run over by the rush of Texans, whipped to a blood frenzy. At a distance, James saw a Mexican officer gallantly standing by the 12-pound cannon, trying to rally the crew into firing at point blank at the charging enemy. A shot from one of the twin sisters struck the Mexican cannon's water bucket and knocked down some of the men. The officer made one more effort, then folded his arms and stood in solemn defiance until Texas bullets cut him down. After those first few brave minutes of self-sacrifice by a relative few, the resistance crumbled. It was no longer so much a battle as a runaway and a slaughter. Soldiers who had rifles threw them down and dropped to their knees, begging for mercy. But there had been no mercy at the Alamo and none at Goliad. Little was shown at San Jacinto, not for a while. By the dozens, then by the hundreds, the Mexicans were killed wherever sword or bullet or rifle butt could reach them. In blind confusion, they jumped into the bayou and tried to swim. Their bobbing heads made easy targets, and the muddy brown waters turned red. Andrew halted after a while, dropping to his knees. James stopped beside him. The Texan line had long since lost any semblance of formation. The companies mixed without any attempt at retaining identity. All that mattered now was to pursue the Mexicans. Let none get away.
What's the matter, Andrew? You hit?
No. I'm just giving plum out. I'm run as far as I can. You go on if you want to. I've had enough.
He took a sweeping, horrified look around him. Dead and dying Mexican soldiers were scattered as far as he could see.
God, yes. I've had enough.
James saw that most of the Texan force had swept on ahead of him. He felt compelled to move forward to try to catch up. But shortly, he came upon a familiar figure. Young Manuel Zaragoza stood with a smoking rifle at arm's length, looking down upon a Mexican officer who lay on the ground, one hand clutching weakly at the air. Blood ran from the officer's mouth. James recognized the man even before Manuel turned his tear-streaked face upward to tell him.
He was my father's good friend. His name is Diaz, and I shot him. Now I wish I had not.
James remembered. This was the Diaz who, as a sergeant, had given him and the family so much trouble when they had first entered Texas. Who had jailed James and Frank for a time in Nacogdoches before Andrew and Alessandro Zaragoza had come to free them. He knelt. The bullet had taken Diaz high in the chest. He was still alive, but barely.
Can we help him?
I don't think so. But we can try.
A couple of men in buckskin came trotting up. They gave Diaz a quick glance.
That Mexican's not dead yet.
The other one pointed his rifle at Diaz's head.
Now he's dead.
The man gave Manuel a suspicious look.
His boy's Mexican too. Is he one of them?
He's one of us. He's with me.
One of them brown-skinned bastards looks just like another one to me. We ought to kill every one of them while we got the chance.
James brought his rifle up, pointing at the man's belly.
You'll have to kill me first.
There's plenty more ahead yonder. Let's go.
Manuel had paled at the shot that killed Diaz. Now he turned and lost what little he had eaten that day. James waited. He saw no reason to go any farther after the arrest of the Texan troops. The outcome was no longer in doubt. Let those who still had a taste for blood continue the chase. The battle had been won.
You better stay with me. Somebody else may mistake you for a Santanista and kill you. I think we've both had enough anyway.
Manuel nodded grimly and turned away from the body of Lieutenant Diaz. James pointed back in the direction from which he had come.
Let's go find Andrew.
The shooting went on sporadically until darkness finally forced a halt to the killing, and Texan soldiers came straggling back. No semblance of company formations remained. Once the shooting had begun, they had become individual fighting men, each going his own way. Had Santa Anna had a few disciplined cavalry units with him, and these had remained cool-headed, they might have made short work of the disorganized Texas force. On another day, or even earlier in the same day, his foot soldiers might have held the line and turned the Texan advance into a rout. But his men had struggled against the elements all the way across Texas, and they were decimated by illness and fatigue. The reinforcements brought that morning by General Koss were especially weary from a night-long forced march. Santa Anna's arrogant overconfidence had caused him to let down his guard and had condemned fully half his force to a violent death. His losses on the field of San Jacinto were comparable in number to the Texan losses in the Alamo and at Goliad. Ironically, reinforcements not many miles away would have tripled Santa Anna's forces had the Texan attack waited much longer. but Houston had taken precautions against that. He had sent scout Deaf Smith to burn the bridge over which Koss and his men had marched early that morning. Any further Mexican reinforcements would have had to swim or find a boat. In burning the bridge, Houston had not only prevented any further reinforcement of Santa Anna's troops, but had eliminated any chance of escape for his own had the battle gone the other way. Late on the day after the battle, a handful of men brought in some straggling prisoners. One of them was dressed much like the rest of the common soldiers, but at sight of him, many of the other prisoners began to show excitement.
It is El Presidente! It is Santa Anna!
Houston had had two horses shot from under him in the fight and now lay in pain at the foot of a live oak tree, one ankle shattered by a Mexican musket ball. But with dignity, he accepted the president's surrender. The proud military dictator, who had once declared that it was a soldier's great privilege to die for him, was reduced to pleading that he not be killed. While other Mexicans cursed him for cowardice, he signed away Mexico's claim on Texas in return for Houston sparing his life. In camp that night, James and Andrew and Sly Shipman began making plans to return home. It was past time to be planting their corn. James was concerned about the lateness of planting. If an early frost should come before the crops matured, part or all might be lost. But Andrew had been here more than 15 years. He said the odds were that they would make a crop despite the late start. Enough, at least, to see them through the next winter. After that, there'd be another spring. A new beginning, just as Texas had been given a new beginning. Gamble or not, the Lewis families were more fortunate than many whose homes had been in the path of Santa Anna's advancing armies. What the retreating Texans had not burned to deprive the Santanistas of their use, the Mexicans had usually torched for their own reasons. Evidently, the troops had not passed this way, for the Lewises found their cabins, sheds, and pens intact. They managed to find and drive back most of their livestock that had strayed up or down the Colorado River. James had lost Walker, and he had never seen the borrowed sorrel again once he turned him over to a cavalry officer for the attack on San Jacinto. He did not know whether the horse had survived. If it had, the chances were that it would seek its way back to its original home the first time it was turned loose. Horses had a strong homing instinct. James was fortunate in catching a Mexican cavalry horse after the battle. It had brought him home. Andrew had gotten his own horse back once the officer who had borrowed him had no more use for him. Finnis and Luke Blackwood finally returned to their place once they were sure all the danger was past. James had hoped never to see them again, but the Blackwoods were like a bad penny that kept turning up. Finnis was indignant over some thieving Mexican soldier having stolen his saddle. James never told him any differently. Finnis eventually got himself another. James didn't see any point in asking where it had come from. Somewhere, some unfortunate was riding bareback. James had the whole cabin to himself, for Annie and Sly Shipman had temporarily moved over to Marie's place so Shipman could work her fields for her and do the other tasks that had been Michael's. Young Mordecai did a man's work, but he couldn't take care of everything by himself any more than Michael had done. James got lonesome being by himself. A double cabin like this was a waste for a bachelor. He began thinking perhaps one day he would take a ride over to the Caldwell place once the crops were in good shape and he could afford to be gone for 2 or 3 weeks. He had been thinking some of late about red-haired Libby Caldwell. She had looked a lot different the last time he had seen her. She had matured and taken on the appearance and attitude of a grown woman. She might not be ready yet for serious thought on marrying, but it wouldn't hurt anything to put in his bid, so to speak. She would be ready one of these days. And if they were both so inclined when the time came, this cabin would not forever be a poor bachelor's nest. It was said, though he had nothing in writing to prove it, that the volunteers who had fought for Texas would be rewarded with land by the new republic. Sly and Annie were counting on that, so they would eventually have a place of their own. James and Andrew could add on to their own holdings. As for Marie, Baptiste Villeray came down from Natchitoches in June, anxious about his widowed daughter and her children. This time he brought old Mother Villeray for a reunion with her daughter and a chance to meet the grandchildren she had never seen. The Villerays pleaded with Marie to go back to Natchitoches with them. They had property enough there, they said. Marie could live comfortably in surroundings she had known as a girl. Her children, starting with Mordecai, could learn a suitable trade.
Marie, this rock country is no place for a young widow.
But I am not a widow. I know Michael is out there somewhere. I can hear him sometimes, talking to me.
The family members would look at each other and shake their heads. Women had been known to lose their good judgment over lesser ordeals than Marie's. Men, too. The Villerays stayed longer than they intended, trying to win her over. On Sunday, the day before the Villerays were to leave, James saw Marie walking around over the farm alone, staring a long time at the cabin, the shed, strolling down to the field where the first corn was starting to rise from the plowed ground. Mordecai walked down to join us. To her mother, she put her arm around her son. Tears glistened in her dark eyes.
Papa, our place is here. All this Michael built, he and I together. Even if something keeps him from ever coming back to me, always you will be here somehow, at this place. I could never leave it, for that would be like leaving him.
Marie put her arm around Mordecai again.
We are a family. We have paid too much for this land to go away from it now. To you, Mordecai is still a boy. But after all he's been through, he is a man. He does not know Natchitoches. He knows Texas. In Texas, he should remain.
Villeray accepted her decision without argument, though James saw a deep sadness in the old Frenchman's eyes. Tomorrow, the Villerays would start the long journey back to Natchitoches. It was possible that Marie and her family would never see them again. But they still had today, and all the Lewis families had gathered for Sunday prayers and the sharing of a meal, as had long been their custom. It was a quiet, reflective time, nobody talking much. James watched Annie and Shipman sitting together at Marie's long table, touching each other often and trying to make it look as if it had been by chance. Annie was showing somewhat now. The baby would be here long before the first frost. Frank had recovered from the illness that had almost killed him at the time of the runaway scrape, though he was slow in regaining his strength. His boys and Hope had been a big help to him in making up for the weeks lost on their farm. Petra had spent much time with Marie, but the two had long been like sisters. When one hurt, the other felt the pain and knew how to help. Andrew did not begrudge the time, for he knew the strain and the loneliness Marie had gone through. Without Mordecai and without Petra's quiet understanding, she would have had a much harder time. Mordecai got up and went to the dog run to check on the animal. He came back into the kitchen trembling a little.
Mama! Mama, come here!
James glanced at Andrew, then quickly pushed away from the table. He rushed out onto the dog run ahead of Andrew. Mordecai pointed.
It can't be, can it?
James's breath caught up short. He felt his throat tightening.
It looks like...
Marie was already running out past the cabin, running to meet the two men riding double on a horse. Mordecai was close behind her, trying vainly to catch up. James and Andrew followed, but did not try to match them. The man in the saddle was wearing a black coat and had a patch over one eye. Behind him, a familiar face showed over the top of the Reverend Fairweather's head.
Well, I just wish you all would look at who I found back yonder ways.
Michael Lewis dragged a long leg across the horse's rump and slid cautiously to the ground.
Marie.
She was in his arms. Mordecai threw his arms around his father. It struck James that the boy now lacked only a foot or so of being as tall as Michael. Andrew glanced at James, tears running down his leathery cheeks.
Oh, praise God. Praise God indeed. I brought home the prodigal father. I hope you good folks have prepared the fatted calf. I am a hungry man.
It took a while for Michael to get around to hugging his two brothers, then the rest of the family by turns. James stared at him, swaying between gratitude and dismay. He had never seen Michael so gaunt and drawn, his face so pale. He looked to be just two steps shy of death.
Oh, we gave you up for dead, Michael, but Marie never did. She always talked like she was sure you'd be coming back.
I don't know how, but I knew. I had dreams. I heard you calling for me. All the time you were gone, I knew you were out there somewhere.
Michael had made the rounds of all the family. He came back to Marie and held her as if he would never let her go.
And I heard you calling me. I think that's what pulled me through, hearing your voice in my head whenever I felt like I was starting to slip away.
Michael went into the kitchen, his arm around Marie. She brought him a plate and one for Fairweather. They devoured the venison as if neither had eaten in a month. Michael leaned back in his chair.
I was down there on scout along the Rio Grande when Santa Ana crossed over from Laredo. His outriders took after us, me and the two that I was with. They shot the others and they put a bullet in my back. I managed to hold myself in the saddle till my horse outran them. I must have finally gone unconscious and fallen off. When I came to, I was lying on the ground. I didn't see the horse anywhere. I wandered a while till an old Mexican with a burro came across me and took me home with him. It was like 20 years ago all over again. Remember Marie when the Spaniards shot me and old Mother Moreno and her boys helped me? This old man and his wife, they took care of me the same way. They said Santa Ana had executed two of their sons down in Coahuila. They hid me when the soldiers came around. I came so close to dying that I could smell the angel's breath. But I'd hear you calling me and I'd hold on tight.
Yes, I did call for you, Michael. Many, many times I called for you.
The old man finally came and told me that Santa Ana had been whipped. All the Mexican soldiers were going back to Mexico. By then, I felt like I was strong enough, so I started walking. It was a long ways for a man afoot. I finally made it to the Willett place this morning. That's where I found Fairweather.
The power of prayer and faith. James, my boy, would you mind handing me that platter of venison? I swear, the Lord's bounty never tasted so good.
Sons of Texas is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1990, Tom Early, a pseudonym of Elmer Kelton. Published by arrangement with Elmer Kelton, care of Sobel Weber Associates, Incorporated, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Tony Nam, Casey Platt, Joe Brack, Eric Messner, Joseph Thornhill, Drew Copas, Michael Glenn, Elizabeth Jernigan, Daniel Stevens, Thomas Keegan, Michael John Casey, Christopher Sheeran, Yasmin Toison, David Coyne, Colleen Delaney, Nathaniel Perry, Christopher Graybill, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, Tim Carlin, Bobby Aselford, M.B. Van Dorn, Richard Rowan, Nanette Savard, Tim Getman, Barbara Pinellini, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Book adapted for Graphic Audio by Johann Detweiler. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Dwayne Beeman. With original music by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Sons of Texas, be sure to look for Elmer Kelton's Huey Calloway and Texas Rangers series. Available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, audio guides, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio presents DC Comics, Green Lantern, Sleepers, Book 3.
Wait, you're a Green Lantern, right? You can't!
The spirit of vengeance has come for you, Detective.
The world, the universe, something's wrong.
Of course it is.
How do you know?
If it wasn't, Neither of us would dress this way.
I'm human again. This is how it starts, isn't it?
What the hell is going on?
Best I can tell, pal, the apocalypse.
Cal, what happened?
Hal Jordan tried to kill me.
Jade, Kyle's ring has security lockouts that prevent others from using it. The only person who could possibly use it is the ring's original owner.
That man is a killer, and now you want me to just give him Kyle's ring?
Kyle battled one sleeper and almost lost the solar system. We're facing thousands.
Promise me you won't go insane and destroy entire planets again.
I can't. Oh my God. It's the JLA. They're all sleepers.
And so Hal Jordan dies, and Sinestro lives.
Green Lantern and all names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics. Copyright 2011. All rights reserved.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.